The sound of their music is authentically human. Just four voices, and they use them in a way that shows the power and the potential of singing. And to accomplish this goal, New York Polyphony is always on the lookout for some new repertoire, that which will really highlight their four voices. Recently, I talked with bassist Craig Phillips. He's also one of the founders of this ensemble, and he told me how they literally stumbled upon a few gems from a 15th century Spanish composer, and that is the basis for their new recording, Lamentaciones. That's what this episode is all about on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. I'm talking with Craig Phillips, the bass in the ensemble New York Polyphony. Thanks for joining me, Craig.
My pleasure.
Now, you are a professor at the University of Oregon, and you've been doing that now for the past 2 years. How's that working as being a member of New York Polyphony?
Well, we were all based in New York for, I would say, about the first 9-10 years of the group. And at some point along the way, some life demands, some demands of having children and getting married, we decided to fan out a bit. And so I spent a brief time in Greensboro, North Carolina, and then made it out here to Eugene. And it's worked out well because we kind of build into our schedule rehearsal retreats, and we try to make sure that we carve out time when we do meet. And we do about 40 engagements a year. So in that time, we find the time to audition new repertoire and make sure that it's, you know, fully vetted on the road. And so it's worked out well.
There are four members in this ensemble. Are they all the original four members?
The current lineup is the longest running lineup, but they aren't. Two of the members are not original members. Our tenor, Stephen Wilson, and our baritone, Chris Herbert, joined the group later, but they've been with us so long, it seems that they've always been there.
And then the countertenor is Jeffrey Williams. Is he a founding member along with you?
Yes. Jeffrey and I founded the group in 2006.
Wonderful. Why was this ensemble created? What's your mission?
Well, let's see. The reason we formed and our mission are kind of two separate things. The reason we formed is we were kind of all mercenary musicians in New York City, and we met on various gigs and discovered that we had in common a love of early music and really wanted to dig deeper than we were in our professional settings. So we made a promise that we were going to get together and just tear through some music. Well, unfortunately, that never really happened. Eventually, an opportunity came about. A producer friend of Jeffrey's called him out of the blue and was putting together a program for Public Radio International. And it was a modern language version of a medieval mystery play. And he needed some Christmas carols to be in the background. And so he charged Jeffrey, said, "Hey, can you put together a group of singers to do this?" And luckily, Jeffrey called us. We got together kind of rather quickly and laid some things down. And at the end of that session, we listened back to those recordings and looked at each other and thought, "Hey, this sounds pretty good. Why don't we continue doing this?" We didn't know at the time, but the producer of that session did the same thing and took the those bass recordings to a record label in London, Avi Records, and presented it and said, "I'm working with these guys in New York. What if we record a few more things and put out a Christmas record?" And that's kind of how it all began. And that was the first disc we released, called I Sing the Birth.
You're also known for commissioning new works and presenting contemporary compositions. Is that something you've done recently?
Yes, actually. You talked about mission. That's been actually one of our missions, to try to explore the area between ancient and modern music and try to work with composers that are inspired by early music so we can contribute to the repertoire. Yes, we have had some recent compositions. We just did a premiere by the American composer Gregory Spears and a major work called The Bitter Good. We've worked closely with the composer Ivan Moody and premiered about a year and a half ago a major work, a setting of the Vesper sequence in Church Slavonic. He's a Eastern Orthodox priest, as a matter of fact. And for our most recent collaboration, we've worked with a Norwegian composer who is a friend of ours who's worked with us since the beginning, a man named Andrew Smith. And he wrote a gorgeous setting of Psalm 55 that we are happy to continue to tour.
I suppose in some ways you could say that the ancient music you've recently discovered and recorded is also made new again.
Yes. As a matter of fact, we have taken a lot of this early music, some of which is quite rare, this music on this disc in particular. I mean, this was overlooked for centuries. We've taken the music on the road to some really strange corners of the United States. I think we've hit 44 or 50 states. And we present it to audiences, many of whom don't have a knowledge or necessarily an affinity for early music. And we're actually surprised at how relevant this music that we present, especially the kind of the modal and you know, very kind of archaic textures, how it resonates with people who are really listening and looking for something that is authentic and not what we say emotionally manipulative. And this music tends to really strike a chord with people.
As I was listening to this recording again today, it occurred to me that as people are looking to be more mindful, perhaps, maybe this music helps them do that.
We feel strongly that it does. You know, it's interesting. We sometimes get questions about the religious tone of our core repertoire. And because most of it is in Latin, the Lamentations on this disc goes back and forth between Latin and Hebrew. These aren't common languages. Most people come to our concerts and don't have an experience with Latin. And because the music, its quality is very kind of ambient and the music is kind of objective, it allows a listener to kind of project whatever they need onto it. So I won't say it's a blank canvas, but it does give people space to bring to it what they will. And that's really, I think, one of the attractions to our repertoire.
This recording includes some rarely heard works from late 15th and 16th century Spanish composers and their predecessors to the composers we might think of when it comes to the Spanish Renaissance, like Tomás de Victoria. Tell me a little bit about how you assembled this program.
Well, believe it or not, it was a happy accident. We try to seek out music that was intended for male voices, as opposed to trying to find things that were for maybe larger choirs, and we transpose it into a comfortable key. We were digging around for new material and actually pulled a book off a shelf, and it was a relatively recent scholarly publication prepared by a musicologist named Jane Hardy of the works of Peñalosa, and we'd had some experience with Iberian Renaissance composers, but we had not really explored Peñalosa at all. So when we pulled the book out and opened it up to these settings of the Lamentations, it leapt off the page. It really looked like music that was written for us. And our vocal configuration is a countertenor, tenor, baritone, and bass. So really smushed in terms of our ranges. And it just looked like, you know, something that we told the composer to write. Thank you. when we started singing it, it just fit like a glove. And then add to it the fact that they're spectacular, profound, very moving pieces of music. It was a no-brainer.
The works that we hear on this recording by Francisco Pinalosa are actually world premieres because they were lost works. Tell me first who he was.
Well, very little is known about Pinalosa, so I can't really speak to that, but I can speak a bit to why these pieces were, quote, lost. The generation of composers that followed Pinalosa that you mentioned, Victoria, Guerrero, Morales, their compositions existed in publications outside of Spain, but that was not true of Pinalosa and some of his contemporaries. They essentially existed in only two manuscripts that I believe were found in the Tarazona Cathedral. So his music was just not distributed. Then there's also the issue that relates to the Franco-Flemish composers that were a lot more prominent in their day and in the centuries that followed. So there's some strange problems with attribution, that there were compositions of Pinalosa that were confused with composers like Pierre de la Rue and Josquin des Prez. So he was kind of an overlooked figure, and we're really hoping that this disc will reveal to people just how special and talented a composer Pinalosa was.
Now, is it true that he actually didn't write that many works, maybe just a couple of dozen?
As far as the works that exist, that have been found, you could infer that. It's kind of not known what his output was. I think it really is just comes down to what has been found. So we're hoping that maybe this disc will make people go look in their attics and discover some lost Pinalosa works.
Oh, wouldn't that be fun?
It would be, yes.
Let's talk about what's so unique about his style of writing. When you said it just kind of, you know, just leapt off the page and looked like, wow, this is perfect for us. What was it about the music that he writes that made you think that?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, he pays close attention, kind of in a way that presages some of the composers that followed. There's a real attention to the drama. I mean, we're not talking Monteverdi Madrigal, but there's a very clear intention to paint the text. And the other part about his writing that I think is just really phenomenal is a kind of less is more approach. If you were to look at the writing on the page, he's very creative with counterpoint. And sometimes, even though there's just the voicings are spare, the sound is amazingly full. So there's not a wasted note, and the way he voices the parts kind of outlines something that's much larger than it actually is. So one of the exciting things for us when we present these works is we often get comments that it sounds like there's so much more, that we're a much larger group. And I think that's really a testament to his writing and how it kind of gives the impression of some, you know, larger architecture.
That's interesting, because I was going to ask you how you have such a full sound, but you're saying it's actually the way the music is written.
In some respects, yes. The other, I would like to think, is based on kind of our approach and the approach that we've always taken with performing this music. We obviously have been influenced by a lot of the great early music groups that came before us, like the Hilliard Ensemble in particular. And there are a lot of groups that really delved into historical performance practice. We're part of a generation, we feel, that is working to really create compelling performances of these works. Not to say that those groups that came before us didn't, but instead of really trying to be true to some sort of historical approach, we're really trying to invest in the passion, maintaining the stylistic appropriateness, but really try to sing passionately. And one of the ways that we're attempting to do that is to approach this less like a small choir where we're working to homogenize our sound, and more like a string quartet where we're giving each other permission to bring kind of the quality, the full qualities of our individual voices to bear on the collective sound. We often say that we're not trying to blend so much as we're trying to balance our sounds in the way that, you know, where you're having a kind of a consort of different instruments. You can still tell, you can hear the individual qualities of the instrument. And we think that in music like this, when we're just one voice on a part, it kind of adds another dimension.
Craig, are the pieces that we hear on this recording, would they be considered works from a mass?
Well, the movements of the mass, yes. The Pignolosa Missa Lo Marmé, we present, I don't know, three or four movements from that mass. We omitted some of the other parts of the mass because they expand to more than four voices. But the Lamentations are kind of standalone works that would be presented during Holy Week, and so they were intended to be presented as part of the liturgical calendar.
The recording opens with a lamentation from Pignolosa, but then we're hearing from other composers.
We include two other composers just to give a more kind of complete survey of the sound of the Spanish Renaissance composers. And we include Escobar because he was a contemporary of Pignolosa. And I believe, actually, he was Portuguese, but actually worked in Spain, if memory serves. And he, like Pignolosa, is another composer that is overlooked. So we thought that we would at least give a nod to him, to kind of pull him from the dustbin of history. And obviously Guerrero is in the generation that follows. So having that contrast, I think you can better appreciate how forward-thinking Pignolosa was.
I was reading about Pignolosa, and there was one critique of his music where it was referred to that he uses a kaleidoscope treatment in the Gloria.
Gloria!
What does that mean?
The kaleidoscope, or the kaleidoscopic quality of how he writes this piece, is really just how the voices work together, and how active and melismatic and kind of a cascading the vocal writing is. Imagine a kaleidoscope. Once you get a lock on the sound, it's just constantly evolving, it's constantly changing, and there's just such color and imagination in his writing. We are as modern listeners to music, we kind of take for granted or don't notice that we are constantly surrounded by music, whether it's piped in at the Gap or the grocery store or wherever we happen to be. And I hope that listeners can just appreciate how intrinsically human, how authentically human the sound of this music is. There's no manipulation. It's just our four voices, unmodified, and used in a way that just shows the power and potential of singing. These composers were trained to actually exploit what is so moving and powerful about the human voice. And that's something that I think seems elementary, but we forget until we're faced with music like this that is just beautiful and simple, and it is just kind of the height of expression of the emotional potential of the human voice. And I hope that people can hear just how much love is invested. I mean, we really love singing together, and we're huge champions for this music.
Lamentaciones, a new recording from New York Polyphony on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. If you're enjoying this podcast, the best thing you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it, help spread the word, and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. I'm Julie Amacher.